Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
You're listening to the Vox Media Podcast Network.
Hey, this is Ariel Helwani, host of the MMA Hour on the Vox Media Podcast Network. Each week, we interview the biggest names in the world of mixed martial arts and beyond. So tune in live every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern over at MMAfighting.com or download the show afterwards on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you then.
Back again, Landed Upside Podcast, SB Nation, Vox Media Podcast Network. Do I have all the things I'm supposed to say right in there?
Yeah, you got that.
That's what I got. Okay. The NBA playoffs are starting soon. I'm Mike. That's Ben. We have a special guest on, sometime contributor to SB Nation, also to the, let me see if I get all these websites right, The Athletic, Fansided. Okay, I'm a little tapped out now. Is that it? Or there's more, right?
That works.
That works, okay.
Those are the three main ones.
Okay.
Finish the introduction. Who are we talking
about? This is Sirat Sohi, Toronto-based writer. Sirat, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. You guys probably know Sirat from her work at SB Nation, The Tip-Off, but also because she just published a big feature that, I don't know if we want to go too far behind the editorial curtain, but this story took a lot of twists and turns based on current events that happened over the course of the year. The story on Dwayne Wade's return to Miami and how that happened. That was not originally a Dwayne Wade returns to Miami story. It sort of became that, right?
Right. It started off as a what Dwayne Wade is doing and can be for the Cleveland Cavaliers story.
That's what happens in the biz. But, you know, it's funny that the story kind of came to us in a really cool way because obviously that's such a cool thing that he came back to Miami and you spent a lot of time talking to him. Really, he was very honest about, you know, how he looked around and was like, you know what, I kind of want to go back home. His teammates were very honest about that. Eric Spoelstra was very honest. What was the one thing that struck you when you talked to Wade, like, with his disposition and where he was at, like mentally, when you had multiple conversations with him, but especially after the one where he had finally been traded, what did his state of mind feel like?
Oh, when he had been traded, I think the thing that I found that really stuck out was just how happy he was. And it really differed from the guy that I talked to in Cleveland. Not that he wasn't happy, but that he was a little bit more introspective and willing to elaborate on certain decisions and why he goes about certain things. But once he got back to Miami, his answers were all very simple. And there's one, like, you know, part of that's in the piece of just, hey, of, you know, I tried to ask him what his thought process was. And he was kind of just like, come on, like, it's home, it's Miami. He didn't say it's home, but like, he was just like, this was a very easy decision. I didn't really have to make any calculations. And then I asked him if it hadn't been Miami, if that sort of stuff would have been in play, the playing time considerations, championship considerations. And he said, yeah, probably it's likely that it would be, but I wasn't in that position, but just with Miami, it's different. He always figured that he'd eventually go back home, not the way that he ended up going back home, but you know, just, I guess, really a couple months earlier than what he probably envisioned.
Did his family move to Chicago or to Cleveland, or has he always sort of just been home basing out of Miami? Like, so in essence, Dwayne Wade, the player, may have left, but the person never did.
Yeah, I think his kids were still going to school in Miami. I'm not sure how much Gabby was going back and forth, and I didn't get to talk to them, but yeah, like his, I know that his son was like, Zaire was definitely in Miami because Wade, prior to being traded, actually, ironically, like just a couple of days before, flew down to Miami to surprise him just for like 2 days or a day or whatever. So, you know, it was, and that kind of tells you like, hey, this was probably already on his mind. Just the fact that, you know, his kids are there and it was his son's birthday and he was there, and it probably was a good familial moment that maybe impacted his decision, maybe not, but, you know, just having something as nostalgic happen as soon to a decision like that probably does affect it.
So what's interesting about the Wade narrative that you framed really well in the story is that you're basically talking, and we talked about this so much during the edit process, like there are kind of three Wades that have come together. There's the, I really want to go home and I am Miami Wade. There's the unselfish sort of sees the whole board and is willing to admit like where his place in the board is, Dwayne Wade. And then there's, I want to win a championship, Dwayne Wade.
Mm-hmm.
And all three of those elements are part of the story. You talk to anyone, you know, you talk to Tom Crean, you talk to anyone that is close to him, there's an element of all those different things swirling through in the decisions he made. I think your story does really well, and I think our listeners would love to know too, is like, how do we get to the point where we went from Dwayne Wade wants to do anything he can to win a championship to Dwayne Wade's kind of just comfortable that he's going back home?
Well, I think that kind of gets back down to the honesty thing, right? Like like you said, he saw the pieces on the board and he saw what his situation in Cleveland would look like. And to him, I think it was just, you know, he didn't really seem to have much of a role left in Cleveland. So, you know, if you can't really impact winning or contribute to winning in a meaningful way as a guy like Wade, I think it's becomes a much easier call to decide to go get away from that part of your career and just go back home.
Yeah, I definitely found the mentality aspects of the piece like really interesting, because I mean, like I'm not a Miami Heat fan. I've been someone who was rooting for them in the finals for a number of years when my Sixers were a downtrodden organization, and you know, I've definitely have a large level, and it's impossible not to, of respect for the way that Wade's always played, both being like the big guard who I think you mentioned being one of the best all time at blocking shots and really being someone who's led from the post as a guard in a lot of ways, which is one of the things I always liked about his game so much. But this mentality of, I think you had a great quote in there where he says something like, if you want to be an individual, like go play tennis or something like that. And that type of, you know, transparency and openness is not something you see from superstars almost ever in their careers, let alone, you know, at the tail end. You don't always get this introspective vibe until the, you know, years after they've retired and they're writing their book, let alone as they're still a part of a playoff, you know, contender and a team who's going to be playing in, you know, this upcoming weekend in the next few weeks at a minimum. And so I guess if one of the questions I sort of had after reading this was, how do the rest of the players feel about having Dwayne Wade back? Like, what is the, you know, the emotion of having this guy who was the cornerstone of the franchise, you know, the MVP of their finals run before the LeBron James era? Was it 2006?
Yes.
Six?
Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, like,
how confident were you at that answer? That was like a very shot. No, you're like 2006? Yeah, that was a very shot in the dark answer.
Well, the problem is when I do a podcast with Mike Encyclopedia Prada, if I'm off by a year,
right?
Mike also edits the podcast, so what'll happen is Mike will have a little caveat when you get to that point and be like, and here's a part where Ben gets a date wrong.
Yeah, it's like a little musical interlude.
That's so I mean, the point is, like, this guy was at an all-world level, and you never really get that introspective look at the ongoing career, like the career that is in the twilight. So I guess for question one, you know, how unique was it to interview and to do a piece on someone who is an open book in that regard? And then the second question is, I know you talked to a number of the other coaches who have been a part of this, Tom Crean and Spo, and there's even some references to the relationship mending with Pat Riley. But what were the other players, the guys who are, you know, the Richardsons, the Johnsons of the world, who were much different even 2 years ago when Dwayne Wade left, and how are they receiving him back into the organization?
Well, to answer your first question, you know, I think talking to somebody who was open was the reason the piece was able to happen, because of the way that we did it. It was just, you know, it was a practice, shoot around, and sit down for different 10-15 minute increments. And that, without a guy that's really willing to open up right away, I think that's very, very hard to pull off. So I think, you know,
that's yourself just a little more credit. You can give yourself a little more credit. You ask some good questions to probe him.
Sure. Sometimes you can ask a superstar like Dwayne Wade some good questions, and
you can
at times just get like absolutely nothing from it. So you know, that was obviously helpful. And to the point of the teammates, though, at the time, like, they were, I think it was their second game back with Dwayne Wade, and they were honestly thrilled. That's what it seemed like. They were, you know, Richardson was a guy who was really happy to have him back, because they, like, Wade kind of mentored him when he was a rookie. And, you know, he was just, you know, just kind of taking it at him. And they were, like, Dragic was talking about how Wade just has this aura and this calmness that kind of comes over you when he enters a game, and also just when he enters a room. And, you know, and he was also saying, like, you know, he wants, like, he also knows what Dwayne Wade is capable of. Like, he played with him prior to when he left, and not in those championship years, but he kind of wants to make sure that, you know, the rest of the team really remembers who he is and what he's capable of doing and what he's meant to the franchise. And, you know, it's a franchise full of people with the same mentality, and it's a mentality that Wade has fostered. So it's kind of natural that they would be able to mesh. Whiteside, when they came back, like, you know, he was excited for these lobs that Wade used to always throw him. Wade, the first possession he gets back into the game against Milwaukee, he throws one of those lobs to him, and Hassan actually misses and gets a putback, because that's just, I don't know, maybe just not something that he was quite used to. So
he's always got to mess something up a little bit.
That's Whiteside. True.
It's always got to be a little messy. The other thing I thought was, I mean, I think you mentioned that Wade sort of has kind of taken on the ethos of Miami. What's also really striking reading your piece is, like, it almost feels like Wade is Miami. Wade is the Heat. I think he even said, like, in his signature line, you know, I'm not for everyone, is sort of, it's like saying, when Spo says Miami is not for everyone, he's sort of saying, in a way, Dwayne Wade is not for everyone. And then there's that sort of weird moment where you bring in Tyler Johnson, and it's like, it doesn't feel like Wade is left, because all Spo wants to talk about is how great Dwayne Wade is, right, even when he's not there. And then he's back, and, like, there's it's like a more benign deification of than what Kobe and the Lakers had, but it sort of comes from, I think, a similar place, which I think is interesting now that he's back.
I think it's very similar. I'd say, like, the place where it's a little bit different is, well, first of all, like, there's no hoopla on tour the way that there was with Kobe, or, you know, $24 million contract or anything like that. But there is definitely deification of the mentality. And that's kind of what we saw a lot with the Lakers, just like the Mamba mentality stuff. But I don't know if that was something that really was a thing that he bred into the franchise. And that might be impossible with a team like the Lakers that has been around for so long and has such an incredible legacy. Whereas Miami, by 2003, I think they, you know, they were one of the expansion teams. They hadn't been around for that long, and obviously Riley had been there for a little while, and they had Alonzo, but it wasn't like this very established legacy or an ethos of what we are. And the fact that Wade's been there for 13 years, and now the months or extra year or whatever he decides to do. Well, definitely, he's going to end up leaving a huge imprint on the franchise.
Yeah, it seems like, and I think, I mean, this is going to be my segue here, is that the brand that Dwayne Wade and Spo and Riley preach and honestly live by, I mean, that's really what the ethos of the team is that you're talking about. It would seem that goes directly in the face of current superstar on the team. I'm not going to say superstar, current star player.
I don't know what you would call
him. I'm not sure.
Current max player. Max player.
Yeah. Whiteside goes by a lot of names, but I'm not sure exactly what we'd label him as.
Super role player.
Super role player. He would love that. We should call him that.
Yeah, super role player.
So
I think you would hate that.
Obviously, you finished this.
Yeah, I think you would definitely.
not fourth quarter player. So if you finish this piece, you have all these great quotes in here about really like this team mentality we're talking about and everything that Dwayne Wade exudes. And then that comes directly in the face of some comments made by Whiteside, right? About, Mike, you could paraphrase it better than I can, but in
essence,
was
like,
why
he was basically like
playing?
Whining about why he wasn't playing. Right. I mean, he was saying, you know, there are a lot of really good centers. Like, why don't I get any respect from the coach?
That's right.
And something like that. I don't remember exactly.
With that in mind, you know, how would you reconcile sort of what you learned from this process and working on this piece with how the organization likely is handling the Whiteside situation?
Well, I can't speak directly to how they're handling it. Like you said, like the piece came out like the day after. So all the reporting I'd done was done. But I mean, and what Whiteside said was basically that, you know, you shouldn't, like, why are they playing to small ball mismatch, small ball again, like, to match up with other teams when they should be using me as a mismatch? And that just seems like a smarter way to go. And it's really not, because
I mean, no,
the Heat's, you know, Miami small ball lineups are very good.
Right. Also, by the way, if they want to go big, they should play Bam Adebayo instead.
Yeah.
Right. Who's also, by the way, a guy that you can play small and big with, which
yes.
is what Spo has been doing a lot more lately, because he does have the speed, and he's also a guy that you should be thinking about developing too. And, you know, I can. Like, has Whiteside ever really been a guy that fits that mentality? Kind of came in, was very talented, and then, you know, there was a while there we didn't really ever know if he was a good defender. Was it like DeAndre Jordan's early years where he just wants to block everything, or, you know, is there something there? And I think to some extent that was overstated. I think his attitude issues kind of clouded the fact that he could contribute a lot. But at this juncture, I think he just needs to realize that he's a bit player among a team of bit players, and there doesn't really seem to be anybody else on the team that has a really big issue with when they're not the guys that are finishing games. And, you know, he's kind of the outlier there, and, you know, it's just something that they're gonna have to deal with. I don't really know how they'll do it, and, you know, it's not easy, but it's also at the same time, like, I can't imagine it being a huge, huge concern for them. And the fact is that he's still in the rotation. Yesterday he played pretty good minutes despite having four fouls, and they kept him in there. So it's just, I'll see to Spo and his ability to make the right decision, especially come playoff time. And that's just something that I think the Suns going to have to learn to live with, because let's say, like, how much leverage does he have in this situation right now, really?
Yeah. Yeah, and the, like, other part is it's sample size related, too. It's like, hey, buddy, we've played 80 games now, so
right.
We have an idea of the rotations. He's going to throw that out there.
Like, he does, Spo does try to throw him a bone.
Yeah.
It's not like he has completely shut him out and Whiteside's in the doghouse. And I'm sure that if Whiteside could be a good Zig while everybody else zags option, of all the people in the world to realize it would be Eric Spoelstra. And, like, you know, every four or five games, a sign will get some run at a crucial moment. Sometimes he'll do well. More often than not, the small ball lineup would have been a better option. This is just not a team that has a high margin for error, at least for most of the season. I think maybe now, I guess depending on where they want to land, I'm sure they want the seventh seed. They could kind of try to experiment a little bit more. But I mean, we've seen every iteration of every lineup that Miami could potentially play, and they're better without Whiteside. And you can't really get away from that.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
And at the end of the day, the best player on the team is Josh Richardson.
Yeah.
Arguably, you know, or Dragic. I mean, this idea. What's that?
I think it's Dragic.
Dragic has sort of been a little off. Yeah. Whatever. This is an argument is sort of the point I think is worth considering. So, like, I think that going back to Wade, like, the reason I think this is also really interesting in context is that, in a way, it's like Miami sort of admitting to themselves that they don't really have much more than a kind of interesting team that isn't going anywhere. Like, one of the things that we sort of ask and pose, and I think the big question that we don't really know the answer to yet with Wade, is like, is this it? Is this just a swan song? Is he done after the year? Or is he like a legit player that can help them? And there. I think if the answer is if he's a legit player that can help him, like, I'm not sure he is at this point of his career in the way that, certainly in the way where Spo's talking about, like, I'd always give the ball to Dwayne Wade with the game on the line, like he did there. Like, he's definitely not that.
You think that's smoke?
Well, he's a coach, but he's the one.
But you're saying you think that's just like blowing smoke up.
Well, I don't know, is it? I mean, that's sort of the thing.
Well,
and
let's pose that. Like, let's say it's game seven.
I kind of asked him that question. I said, hey, like, you know, you're a very tactical guy. And the last time I actually interacted with Spo was when they were in Toronto, when they ran like the pretty much the exact same set to open up a guy. And it ended up being two different guys, and it was two games in a row. The first was against the Jazz, where I think they got
Richardson
the layup.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
And then they got Wayne Ellington a three-pointer with the same set, just extended out a little bit. They went to, like, the third option on it. And, you know, I was saying, like, this is, like, the last time we talked, I tried to figure out who the first option on an intricate set was, like, that was like, and now you're saying Dwayne Wade with the ball in his hands, and he kind of just held too. He was like, yeah. He also did say that, you know, at the same time, he's able to use Wade as a decoy because that's also what everybody expects to happen. So there is, it's not like things are completely going in a direction where, like, Wade's turned into the Kobe of the team or anything like that. Like, that Philly game winner, for example, was after possession, which they didn't call a timeout, so it wasn't like Spo was like, here, Dwayne, this is your ball, and it was just kind of like, what happened? So I think there's definitely a little bit of a balance. And Miami's also a team that's been really wayward in crunch time all season, so I think
successful though, right?
At the time that we wrote that, so I wrote an article for the Tip Off about how Miami's found crunch time success despite not having a go-to guy. Prior to trading for Wade, they had lost five straight games, and they were all, like, not all of them, but there were some close games in there that they really fell apart down the stretch, and they weren't able to do the stuff that they did earlier. So they were, it was definitely more up and down than the time that we touched base with them. I think that was in January.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
One of the best parts about that Dwayne Wade game winner that you wrote about against the Sixers was that there was an almost identical situation maybe 2 weeks prior, 3 weeks prior, where he missed the game winner against the Sixers. Mm-hmm. But it was still the same basic principle, like put Wade in a little isolation. I think it was with Simmons on him even, and see if he can still make the game winner. And I definitely found, like, the symmetry of the make in that game to be kind of like, well, this is the plan. Like, this is what we will fall on the sword with.
Well, I think the implication, too, I think of that, that moment is like, is this the last magical moment of Dwayne Wade's career in is it Center or American Airlines Arena? Whatever.
Arena.
It's Arena. I always
Center
mix
is
that.
Dallas?
I always mix those two up. But yeah, I mean, that might be the last sort of, I mean, this image of him jumping on the scores table and screaming, this is my house. And that's why
the image we have in our eye, in, like, in our heads, seared in of Dwayne Wade. Yes.
Yeah. I'm not going to go with the obvious pun of sear at it in. From
you just
the story.
Did. You just
yeah,
did.
I just did. Okay, yeah. My bad. thank you for not laughing. But yeah, I mean, it's like Miami is almost in this sort of superstar vacuum now with the team. And that's why the Whiteside stuff is sort of a weird little tie-in. And then here comes, you know, Dwayne Wade in his swan song, like sort of filling that void. And it's a weird, I think it's like on track with what Miami has done the last since LeBron left. It's like sort of this weird admission of we're just kind of a nice franchise that wants to have a certain brand. We're not really competing for titles and stars and whatever in the same way. Like, we're just happy kind of being the Miami that isn't what has a history. The Miami that still has Wade can sell Miami Vice jerseys and profit off them, and then just kind of bring Wade back for these magical moments. But, like, it's not a team that's really going anywhere,
right?
You know, so I that's why I'm sort of.
I don't think that's how they felt the start of the season, though.
You don't think so? That's a, so.
No,
what do you think got them there?
I was in Miami at the start of the season working on a Dion Waiters profile, and they kind of, like, they doubled down on all their guys, and they kind of expected everybody to make a jump. And obviously, they started they ended the last season 30-11. So and barely miss the playoffs, and they kind of expected themselves to be the team that they were in the second half of the season. I think they expected more health than they've gotten, which is, I don't know, it's something that I'm not a doctor, but I think maybe we might need to start looking at the Miami Heat program.
With all the conditioning, you're saying.
All these guys are going to keep going down. That's a discussion for a different day and after some digging in, maybe. But yeah, I think they definitely expect it to be better than they are right now. And I still think that if they're healthy, I think they believe that they can make noise in the playoffs. And, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, they're probably thrilled to have the seventh seed and right now. And it looks like they're probably going to keep it. And we'll see what happens.
I have no idea what the tiebreakers are. They're all way too confusing.
If Boston beats Washington, Miami's going to be locked in. And Washington's going to be locked in.
Celtics will be ideal.
We're just going to date this podcast by, like, you can only listen to it today.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. Like, I wanted to get into the playoff stuff because I do think that, like, there's a whole different dynamic when you're Dwayne Wade's age and all of a sudden you know that it's a one game at a time with a day or two in between. You can get more from that. So is there an expectation that there will be more juice squeezed from the Dwayne Wade, you know,
Miami.
I think that's what they're hoping for, and that's actually kind of what happened in their last season prior to Wade leaving. Because if you looked at those numbers from that season, Wade's on and off numbers, especially compared to Dragic, and, you know, if you compare the usage rate and stuff, it seemed like Goran should be handling the ball more. And Wade had I think he had a negative net rating for the season that year.
He did. It was a whole big talking point, I remember. It's like, Wade is cramping Dragic. It was like sort of a little mini thing in Miami.
Right. And then we got to the playoffs and suddenly Goran couldn't do anything. And that's, you know, that was a series I watched very closely, and it was very much Dwayne Wade bailing out a lot of bad offensive plays. And it was a guy who didn't hit a three since December. And then come April, an elimination game in the first round, he hits two and saves them. Like, there are things that he's able. That's why I wanted to write the story, because he kind of has been able to contradict everything that we should believe, given how much knowledge we have now. And I'm very, very interested to see if that's something that will happen again.
Or if the Philly moment was, like, it.
Yeah.
I watch those games and you're an opposing fan and you're like, if Dwayne Wade hits a three or something like that, or a couple long contested twos in the first half, you're like, nice, that's great. He's going to take those later in the game, and those are not.
And then you're
shots.
Like, God damn it, don't take that later in the
and
game.
Then, yeah, and then but then, of course, he obviously hit the game right. in that one particular instance. But, yeah, I mean, one thing that has stuck with me this whole season, and this is something, Mike, that you told me, I think it was after one of the contentious Sixers Heat games this year, and they all are, because the Sixers are young and the Heat are what you described as a try-hard team.
They can still meet, by the way. There absolutely. Is a chance,
and
right?
I've told you this the other day.
If the Heat beat Boston, which is definitely in play.
Aren't the Heat playing Toronto?
They're going to play in the, like, you mean in the regular season?
Yeah. No, I mean, there's still a chance for that to be a 3-6 series, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
If Philly wins out and the Miami beats Toronto, isn't that the 3-6?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So the point is, like, that there's always been, like, some animosity there. And part of it's because the Sixers are a young team that works real hard. And the Heat are a team who, like, they genuinely don't leave, you know, anything to be desired effort-wise. They really do work their balls off. And, like, I mean this when I say, like, I didn't want to play the Heat as a Sixers fan in the first round because I fear Spoelstra. I think he's an incredible, like, chess piece that other teams don't have necessarily in the coaching position. And then also just that, like, yeah, in an isolated last 3 minutes, like, I still don't want to face Dwayne Wade. I know that sounds crazy to some
that's
other
what
Sixers
they're counting
fans
on,
or,
right?
or national sports fans who are like, this guy's years removed from that. But I watched it firsthand this year, and there's still always going to be that, just like to the effect of the piece you wrote, like that Dwayne Wade appeal in Miami in the clutch. That's still a thing. Until the day he retires, that's a thing. In more so than when Kobe was working out the back end of a, you know, a ludicrous contract.
Right. That's the interesting thing about it, right? Like, that's, it feels so different from any other superstar in his twilight, not just because of his ability to see things for what they are and his ability to defer, but, you know, maybe that feeds into it. Maybe he has more energy at the end of a game and he can kind of summon certain things, but just he kind of makes it happen in ways that will leave you kind of a little bit gobsmacked and questioning what reality is.
Yeah, he's yelling at what was it the purple shirt dude in Charlotte that he yelled at after? Yeah. Oh,
God. He's like a doctor or something.
Yeah, he was like, yeah. But I mean, no, that, and to go back to the larger point, like his ability to see the board, like he, in a way, this worked out really well for him. He gets to be, he doesn't have to live with like, oh, I left home and with animosity. Like he can no longer be blamed for like the whole contract negotiations that happened. He got to chase his title. He got to play at home, and now he gets to go back and like really anything he does is gravy for the rest of the season. Yeah. Like any game winner he has, any performance he has, like nobody's going to remember if they get swept 4-0 and he stinks.
Right. You know? No.
And it sort of works out nicely. And do you think this is it though? Do you think he's done after this year?
Oh, I don't know. I think that's totally, I don't think he knows. And I think it totally depends on how he plays in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Interesting.
I think all this stuff that we're wondering, I think that's something that he's wondering. I think it's something that Spo's wondering. It's just, it's a really, really wait and see type of situation.
All right, we should talk a little bit, just because we have three people here who are, I think both all of our actual rooting teams of interest are going to be in the playoffs. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Teams you follow, at least.
Teams you follow, let's right. say. Yeah, sure. And I believe, I mean, I was this a Raptors Wizards? Could this be a thing right
God,
now?
God, please put my team out of their misery, Toronto. So please put them
Mike
out.
Go first.
Put me out of my misery.
Mike, do you think that the Wizards would have the same team that you're asking to be put out of the misery could definitely flip a switch? They've done this.
They totally could. That's why I want them to be put me out of my misery. Like, this is like going to be the dead cat bounce for the fifth year in a row.
It's an interesting matchup, though.
Do you know how terrified everybody in Toronto is
I'm
facing
sure.
the Wizards and losing game one at home.
Oh, yeah. It'll be the fifth straight year.
I've already got my column ready. I'm waiting to hit set.
Do you think they'll be in the noon, the 1 p.m. Oh, game or whatever?
The noon.
Oh, I think that's got to be Boston-Miami now, if that's what happens.
Well, that'd be like ruining a tradition. It'd be, again, four straight years they've lost the first game of the playoffs at home, right?
Right.
Four straight years.
Yeah. To lesser teams. Yeah. I mean, the Nets.
Yeah, they're always the higher seed.
They've never won a game one at home, I don't think.
Right. And yeah, and always in that afternoon slot. Always the first game.
Well, that's where they get stuck. I don't think they will this year just because Boston and Miami, if like, I'm assuming that will happen just for conversation's sake, because I can't do this anymore. Yeah, like I think the fact that Boston lost Kyrie kind of gives the NBA the excuse of, like, you know, we don't have to put Toronto in that
absolutely
in that situation anymore.
You would hope.
Al Horford, I actually think his middle name is NBA TV.
Yeah,
but he's actually the most NBA TV player of all time, and he kind of maybe can throw it back to his days with the Hawks.
Exactly, I was gonna say he's already been like the lead for the telecast. They could just go back and put a Celtics jersey on the old Al.
Yeah, but see, here's the problem: is that they don't make their decisions based on the player. They make their decisions based on the fact that Al Horford wears Celtic green instead of Atlanta.
Yeah.
And orange and red.
Celtic green has a lot of fans that would love to watch on non NBA TV.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, I think that's the thing really here. So,
and their advertising revenue, like in fairness to the commercial side of this, they just don't get anything from Canadian viewership.
Yeah.
It's true. It's not, I mean,
they're all in the square. That's the problem. Yeah. They're all watching on one TV instead of on individual TVs.
All in the square. Make sound Toronto is like a little villa, like the country of Iceland watching that.
It's just going to make that comparison. Like Iceland soccer. Yeah.
No, the difference
is. Was it true that 99% of Iceland watched the Euro 2016?
Yeah, when I was in Iceland last year, I stood in the middle of the square. You can, it's tiny.
I've been there too. Yeah.
And like, it's a tiny area.
You didn't come here to listen to Iceland soccer takes. So,
anyhow, it's similar though. But I was gonna say, like, and this is a question I always have for people who cover teams in areas where their sport might not be the biggest sport. So, does it matter in Toronto like for the Raptors fandom and overall passion that the Maple Leafs are also in the playoffs and have a obviously a strong team again this year? Does that
Oh, it definitely will. Yeah. It definitely will. It's a hockey country. It's still a hockey city despite all of the growth, and you know, you definitely see more Raptors gear. And actually the last few games this season, I saw more people just outside waiting, trying to get in early and whatnot. Like the sights and sounds of Raptor fandom are definitely present in Toronto. But I mean, the Maple Leafs are just so much more important to Toronto, and they always will be. And
it's Bruins
too. It goes for like pretty much any hockey team. And by the way, they have Austin Matthews, who, you know, can give a franchise a lot more hope
than
pretty much anybody on the Raptors. Very good.
So you just
and
said
he's very young.
I follow hockey real closely as well. I follow all sports real closely. Just so happened to do this NBA thing with Mike. You said Austin Matthews' name, and Mike's eyebrows went up like, that's a hockey player?
It's a very it's a very hockey player name.
He's the future of Team
USA
Austin hockey.
It's Austin with an O too.
It is,
and the O is not where the aw sound.
Oh,
Austin. He's from like Arizona or something, right? He's like a.
Oh, I think I read about this guy once. Didn't we write a story on him like back in the day?
Still, okay. Like 20 years old or something like that.
Yeah,
but, I just always fascinated because like, look, the Philadelphia is a place where the Flyers have been in the playoffs more or less every season for the last like 25 years, with the exception of like 3 or 4 years total. And the Sixers obviously haven't been there for a long time. And the city right now is not even sure what to do because it's a hockey town this time of year. And the reality is it's a complete basketball city right now. The Sixers wave has completely taken over the city. And so being able to watch that dichotomy play out is something that a lot of cities go through, and I'm just trying to rethink in my head right now. So that's why I wanted to bring that up. But
Is there like a collective energy though?
It is a collective energy.
No, but like that's the thing. Like they you can root for both teams, so there's like a multiplying factor, right?
Yeah, and I mean they play in the same arena, so they're never going to be playing at the same time.
Yeah.
So that definitely helps too. And I mean at the end of the day, it's a huge city that has always had a huge sports fan base. The Leafs will definitely get a lot more hype, and you know, you'll see them on TV more up here, which is going to be really ironic when Raptors fans start complaining about American coverage and they can't even get TSN and Sportsnet to cover them.
But, I can't wait for that.
That's definitely funny.
But at the end of the day, like both arenas are going to sell out, and they're both going to have a great vibe, and you know, the Raptors are not going to feel the effects of hockey taking over on a very intimate basis, other than fans complaining that they can't watch them on TV.
Do the Leafs also have a tradition of losing game one at home?
I would not know.
Okay.
I could tell you that, Mike, the Leafs haven't been in a standard in the playoffs for a number of years. It's be their second year in a row, I believe.
Aren't they like the Sixers of the NHL, where they sort of did the trust the process, tear down, rebuild thing?
No, but no.
Oh, because they were accidentally good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like they kind of messed up.
The Raptors then. Okay.
There's not a direct parallel, but what the Leafs did was they brought in like the most successful coach/GM combination you could bring in, and like Babcock used to be the guy who kind of took over for Scotty Bowman in
Scotty
Detroit.
Bowman, I've heard of him.
He's a Hall of Fame coach.
That name
Anyhow,
I've heard.
But Babcock's a guy who's like very well revered and flipped the script, and he's just a great coach. There's a lot of tactical changes, and hockey's not a sport like the NBA where the season starts off and you've got a pretty good idea of the 4 or 5 teams who are going to be in that final four.
Yeah.
The NHL is
why do they play 82 games in hockey? The playoffs are just totally random anyway. It seems like a waste.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot of validity to the randomness of hockey and ultimately most sports other than basketball.
Well, see, that actually leads to a question I wanted to talk briefly about at the end of the show, which is the 82 game thing. Like, is it just me or has this season felt like this is the tipping point for we need to shorten the season?
I think so. I think, and you know, with Adam Silver actually being open to the possibility, when you consider the amount of player injuries, I mean, it's something that we kind of addressed in the Houston piece. I think, you know, maybe the modern game can't afford all this player movement on both ends and 82 games at the same time. Like,
I am
think,
so with you on this. This is like, I
we
could not agree
the
more.
Kyrie Irving paradox?
His body was I talking to you about that or was it someone else? Basically, the idea that, so I think we were saying that this was the first year that Kyrie Irving tried hard on defense and moving without the ball, and oh, wow, he has a knee injury.
a wear and tear knee injury.
Yeah.
Right. Like, but I mean, Kyrie gets this, just to contradict your point a little bit, I mean, Kyrie has knee problems.
Right.
Yeah.
He had them when he didn't play defense too.
Right.
But it was back when he did have slightly more of a role on ball back before LeBron came to Cleveland.
No, sure. I mean, he's had knee problems, but he also didn't miss the entire postseason last year.
That's true. But no, sure. I mean, I think the point is, like, you look around the league, and I think we'd all agree here, like, the NBA would be better if DeMarcus Cousins was playing for the Pelicans in these playoffs. It'd be better if Porzingis didn't miss the entirety of the year. And some of these are blown-out ligaments, like Achilles and ACLs. Now, I can tell you, as someone who's blown out his Achilles, like, it is a wear-and-tear injury. You might have small signs that you disregard. You might ice something that is slightly agitated, not knowing that that is a major ligament that's fraying, and obviously... Then you throw a week in where you have 5 games in 7 nights, and that's it. That's the end of
And by the way, Cousins playing more in the perimeter and driving this year than ever before.
Bringing more rebounds up the court himself and running primary. And you're right.
I didn't even think about that, though. I think that's very much a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that the league is going to have to look into. And I think, thankfully, and I think we'd all agree here, like, this is the one commissioner who will assess something objectively, look for the best, you know, I would say what's best for the players, which is not always what commissioners in most leagues do. Usually they're thinking first and foremost about profitability and what the owner's best interests are. And so I think this is maybe the league that would make the change. Now, the question is, what do we do with that revenue that will be cast aside, which are those X amount of home games per team? And I don't think anyone's really put together the best answer for what, you know, a 68-game season looks like or whatever.
Right.
Right. Like, I think the sweet spot would be 66 because that would eliminate every back-to-back, I think. And you know, it's really interesting. I've been trying to talk to players about this here and there just to try to get a feel of what they think. And I was talking to CJ Miles about injuries, and he was kind of saying, like, the preseason is a bit of an issue.
The lack of one, you mean?
Right. And that they're kind of rusty. And then also having that week-long All-Star break, guys get rusty and then they come back right into action in the middle of a season. And they're kind of in that place where when you get a week off, your body kind of starts to relax. But it hasn't really gotten to that state where it's actually starting to recover from anything. Like, you're kind of just still in that rust period.
That is interesting.
And when you consider the amount of the injuries that happen after the All-Star break, it's kind of like, oh, okay. Like, that kind of...
Because a lot of them did, right? I mean, Jimmy Butler's did. Cousins' was either right before or right after. I forget.
Steph. Although Steph's, you know...
Steph's was... Yeah. I mean, that was not a bit of a freak injury. Yeah. But yeah, Steph, Kyrie, although it was a little... No, that's... I hadn't thought about that, but... That also, by the way, speaks to, like, maybe the solution isn't, like, to just sit players for entire games all the time.
Right, and the Raptors actually aren't doing that.
Yeah.
What are they doing instead? They're
just going to play guys low minutes, and they're going to, like, that's kind of what they've been doing. They'll rest somebody here and there, but, like, you know, they've clinched, and they've clinched for a little while now. Nobody's getting 3 full days off. That's just not what they're doing. They'll play guys 20 minutes, whatever. They'll, like, you know, if somebody, I mean, Fred VanVleet sat out last night because he actually has a bit of a back issue right now. Nothing crazy, but just something that, you know. I mean, hopefully nothing crazy. Who knows? It's a back injury, so.
Right. You don't have to talk to us about that.
Yeah. Right. I got a lumbar support on the chair I'm sitting in right now. No, I'm just kidding. I don't, but I
would have believed you if you did.
No, it's definitely something that has been coming up more and more. And look, there's always going to be your fair amount of your fluke injuries. That's guy goes for jump shot, lands on someone's foot, and rolls his ankle. Assuming that
Joel
Zaza,
Embiid's facial
yeah,
injury.
Yeah, assuming Zaza's not purposely putting his foot under you. Yes, Joel Embiid's facial injury is the quintessential freak injury, and he'll be okay.
Ironic because it's him, but yes.
Of course. That, like, the guy who does not need bad luck gets hit with the shoulder of God, if you will.
Right.
Markoff Fultz. But anyhow, it was. It's like that's a reference to the hand of God.
I know what the reference was to.
We're almost in World Cup phase. We're hitting on all these sports that no one who listens to this podcast likes. This is perfect.
Okay, we got to start a World Cup
podcast.
Usually
what we do when we want to lose listeners is we get into...
I think wrestling kind of transcends most.
I don't know anything about wrestling.
Yes.
Why is everybody so excited about Raw all of a sudden? I don't get it. Like,
yeah, I don't get it either. But I was just saying that from, like, assuming based on what I've seen from everybody else's timelines and every time I log on Twitter and there's anything remotely related to wrestling going on.
I think I honestly think it's because it's like, all right, for example, not everyone follows politics, but like a lot of people will watch the State of the Union address because they just want to be able to say that they watched it. That's kind of to me what WrestleMania is.
I think
like,
you're right.
I tuned into. I haven't watched wrestling.
Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And WrestleMania, there are a lot of things about it that are like the Super Bowl. It is big and flashy. It goes on for like 8 hours. The actual game itself is like an ancillary part of the event. I watched like maybe an hour of WrestleMania. And again, it was like the, whatever the quote is from Big Lebowski. It's like, you're like a child who walks into a movie theater and wants to know what's going on. That's what happened to me. Like I put this on and was like, who the fuck are these people?
Right.
I remember The Undertaker because he was a wrestler when I was a child and still watch this stuff. But like, I think the idea is that like sports writers think of it as almost like a night off to just be entertained and not take shit seriously.
Right. Well, I think it's also the bandwagon effect of everybody else is tweeting about it, so I better
absolutely
tune in. That's I definitely think that's what happened. That's what happened with the Bachelor.
Superdome, packed with people. That's that right there is one of the 10 meccas of sports in America.
Ooh, this is actually a good list.
Superdome,
what are the meccas?
Sure. Yeah.
10 meccas of sports
in Superdome, the North. Let's say North America because
North America, sure.
To include Canada,
sure. But I mean, like, there's
like
the
Madison Square Garden.
Yeah,
there's.
You want to do this? The Rose Bowl is one of them.
The Rose Bowl.
I honestly still think the Forum is a special place, even though they don't really play many sporting events there. But it's still a great
Wrigley Field.
Yes, Wrigley, Fenway, whatever. You know, you can go down the list of.
Okay, I don't know why we're
Meccas,
doing this.
But the Superdome
so
has
dumb
importance on other levels too, which is it housed thousands of people during Katrina. It is a beacon of New Orleans and. So WrestleMania is definitely one of those things.
Bachelor is the other one. The Bachelor Twitter is that is the other one that everyone suddenly has jumped on board.
I don't know much
recently
about that space, if I'm going to be honest. We've railroaded a really succinct podcast.
Are you as excited as I am for the Angst Bowl on Wednesday? Minnesota, Denver, the loser.
Oh yeah,
missing the playoffs, being a total disaster for their season. Even
I've
though
been calling it High Noon for like a week now.
Who do you think wins? What's your prediction? Both you guys.
I think Denver's playing better, but it's at Minnesota. So, and I have a hard time believing that Jimmy Butler's going to not let them win. I think it's going to be one of those games where, like, Butler, suddenly his minutes limit doesn't matter. Taj Gibson plays 45 minutes. Andrew Wiggins gets benched down the stretch, and Minnesota pulls it out by, like, 2 points, like 87 to 85. Like,
kinda... I think the other problem is that – sorry to cut you off.
I got nothing.
Oh, yeah.
The other issue is that Denver's been working from behind for so long, and they've been kind of, not to use a sports cliche, but they've been kind of willing themselves to a couple victories here, and they've, I don't know, I just, like, can you, how much longer can you keep burning that candle? They might be more exhausted than Minnesota is at this point, since Minnesota's up until this point kind of safely been in the seed, and I think it might just come down to the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, maybe Denver just being on the road runs out of juice in the last 6 minutes of the game. And I think that's kind of what's going to happen. I want Denver to make it because I really just want all of the chaos to erupt in Minnesota. And I want them to have to make so many changes. And like, I want every single person in that locker room and coaching staff to have to look in the mirror and be like, what the hell is wrong with me? Why am I so stubborn?
I agree.
But at the end, like, I think it's kind of just going to come down to one of those games where it's close until the last 6 minutes. And then, you know, by the end, it's like kind of they've got a cushion. They win by like 8 or 9.
So I want to say that I want to go on the record, say I'm rooting for Denver and have been. I kind of like, in general, I think we've been pro
Denver
on this podcast. They're fun to watch.
Yeah.
And also, like, they'll add a little flair to the first round matchup against Houston. Like, I don't know. Like, I just want to see Jokic get into the playoffs, get that first, like, burn under for him and that experience. But
watch him get switched onto James Harden over and over again and have to internalize that for an entire summer.
Which is such a terrible matchup. I'll say that, like, a couple weeks ago, they came into Philly and in a very important game and played absolutely horrible. So I really hope they don't bring that level of defensive lack of integrity.
I think they would get swept by the Rockets.
They probably might. It's not an ideal matchup for them, but it's not like I'm sitting.
I mean, Minnesota
like,
would win like one game.
Yeah,
I think Minnesota might get swept too.
again, but, like, just in this particular matchup, I will say there's something to be said for the team who's already been playing, for all intents and purposes, playoff basketball, elimination basketball, for the mentality that they're able to bring into that game. And you see this a lot in baseball, where there's usually one wild card team who's been playing like four or five games above the wild card clip, and another one who squeaks in. And the momentum's actually on the side of the team who's been playing with desperation. And that it almost always plays out like that. That's why a lot of times you see the play-in game team in the in March Madness win their first round, because they've already had that level of heightened intensity,
so
they know how to cope with it better. And I think there's something to be said for that for Denver. They've been playing for their playoff lives for a week and a half now.
Also, I watched the Memphis game the other night, or a little bit of it. Minnesota didn't look that good. No, like, they looked real tight.
That was not a good Memphis.
That was not good.
I was tuning in and out of that game, and I was just like, what? How is this happening? Like, they just, every time it looked like they were going to pull away, they just somehow, like, have some inexplicable turnover, and Memphis would go and make it a game again.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they were just tight. They weren't passing the ball. Like,
yeah.
Oh, if they lose.
Yeah, exactly. I think
if they lose that game.
I think they need to lose. I think they, like, if they make it, so much of what has happened this season will kind of be vindicated. Even though being like the, I'm sure they had loftier goals than being the 8 seed, but they needed to make the playoffs. And if they do, then they're going to kind of keep going down this path, and it's going to lead nowhere good, nowhere near the potential that they have. And, you know, I think it'd be really good if they lost and just reevaluated some things.
And, Tibbs will say, well, we made the playoffs and we were only 3 games out of the 3 seed.
Yeah, but then I remember that they've been out of the playoffs for 12 years running, and then right. I'm like, yeah, I mean, yes, but at a certain point, like, you just, like, you run out of water.
I just want to play the long game with this team, you know?
The long game would stop being played the second they signed Taj Gibson, Jeff Teague, and hired Tom Thibodeau, so we're kind of, I feel like the long game is already out.
Well.
Sadly.
I mean, it's a kind of shorter long game, like the, hey, let's see if Tom Thibodeau should be coaching this team long game.
Let's
put the 3 stars in a room together and make, like, lock them in there until they figure out how to be friends.
Can I ask a last question to both of you? Is there an undercurrent in the NBA writer world of rooting for Tibbs to fail? Because I feel like there is. And I'm not saying I root for him to succeed. I'm just, it's
a curiosity. Why do you think so? I'm curious about this.
What do I think?
I think writers are
player-friendly people in general, and I think that Tibbs is a coach who usually wears down the effectiveness of players that people like.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Yeah.
I think there might be some of that, but I think it's largely because Minnesota is so frustrating to watch, and people wanted them to be good so badly, and, like, you can kind of pull back the strands and see why they're frustrating. And, you know, you look at the fact that he's not getting to them defensively and offensively. They produce, but they're not running their optimal offense. And it's very just, they're a very grating team to watch because of these little decisions that just keep holding them back. So I think maybe that's getting taken out on Tibbs because we wanted Minnesota to be better than they are.
By that.
I think that's true. I also think that Tibbs represents sort of function over form, in a way that I think a lot of really diehard NBA fans don't romanticize the league. Like, I don't. You know, it's very much like a science experiment, plugging holes. This isn't fun. This isn't art. This is just like me going into my lab and, like, kind of doing what I need to do to get to point A to point B and not worrying about how I do it. You know, to make a soccer analogy, he's very, Sam Allardyce, Mourinho-esque. I would say maybe not Mourinho, but that's sort of like, it doesn't matter how we get to however many points in the table, we just get there, and that's the beauty of it. And I think at least I'm speaking for myself, and I think I'm speaking for a lot of people. It's like, no, that's not why we watch basketball. Like, we don't watch basketball to, you don't watch the Premier League to watch Everton get 45 points, you know?
Right.
Like, you watch that league for them to shoot for getting way more points, and then if they fall short, at least they tried.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a little bit of that going on with Minnesota, and it's compounded because, like Sirot said, the players themselves are such top prospects and have so much of a future that it almost feels like
Even Wiggins, Mike?
Let's not talk about that. But yeah,
we need to do a psychological profile today. We'll save that for a different podcast.
So I think you're right. I mean, I don't know if that's like rooting for him to fail, but I mean, I do think it's like they're not very fun, to put it simply. You know, they're not fun to Wolves fans. They're not fun to neutrals. They just kind of are. And, you know, if they were the 90s era Cleveland Cavaliers and had Terrell Brandon and a bunch of no names, that's fine. But they have two number one picks and a superstar, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
that's sort of where you want something that's more of a multiplying effect.
Did you pick Terrell Brandon because he was also on like the last Minnesota team to make the playoffs?
I was just thinking of like the most boring coach of the 90s, and I couldn't stop thinking about that Mike Fratello Cavs team.
Yeah, that's definitely up there. There's no doubt.
I don't know. I mean, it's very much
but
like...
But that was when they had that cool, nice blue, that smooth
the funky
blue.
Funky logos.
The funky logos in the blue and Bobby Surra.
Oh, man, the 90s logos.
Yeah, we don't have to get to it.
Was that where... The Raptors had some real doozies that decade, too.
Great uniforms.
That's one word for them.
They had beautiful, beautiful. They had uniforms that anyone on Nickelodeon would have been proud to rep.
I mean, when you're wearing these retro clothes, ironically, that sort of says it all.
Yeah. We can be on the lookout for all of the 1990s retro uniforms at upcoming music festivals around the country.
Yeah, or you can go to SBNation.com's Jersey Week from the summer.
That's true.
And
there was
relive
a Jersey
it there.
Week. But nice. All right. Well,
nice work.
This was a lot of fun. We have Mike got a Sam Allardyce. He's the Everton manager reference in there. I know that everyone caught that.
Is that like a fair analogy? It's not a fair analogy. It'd be like, it's the closest thing I can think of because Everton is like seen as a actually interesting progressive team, and he's made them remarkably dull and functional.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. I just don't think that as many people get the EPL parallels to the NBA as you
I don't think Sierra, did you understand any of that?
I'm staring at straight ahead of you right now.
Same.
It's kind of like when you guys were talking about Austin Matthews.
Yeah. With an O. Austin with an O. All right, well, cool. Well, I, you know, like this is always interesting for me to be able to kind of pick the brain of the people who write the articles that I read all the time here. So, Sierra, I really appreciate, like, you joining this, number one. Number two, putting up with our soccer analogies. Number three, talking about wrestling. These are all things that we did not necessarily put on your plate when you decided that it was okay to join this podcast. So so definitely appreciate your time here. And is there anything you're working on currently for SB or even just in for your other platforms that you publish on that you want to promote here?
Right now we're going to do an Indiana thing for some point this week, just a playoff preview type of thing. And other than that, I mean, I think it's probably just going to be time to lock down on the Raptors stuff. Seems like the direction it's going. The playoffs are about to start. I'm here. They are the one seed. It seems like the logical decision. So I don't know, just watch out for Raptors stuff and mostly at SB Nation, I think. And you know, we'll see what happens.
Cool.
Yeah.
God, after they lose game one again.
Oh, I'm so excited. I'm so thrilled.
To Mike's Wizards. Well, when the series is going into game seven, we'll have you come back and we'll do a little game seven preview. Mike, well, I'm sure we don't.
I swear, like, just end this Wizards season. This season has been so exhausting.
Well, I hope the Raptors do that for you, Mike.
I would love it if they could swap places with, like, I don't know, Detroit clearly wants to make the playoffs. Like, let them play in the playoffs.
Yeah, yeah. Too late for that.
Let's not get the dead cat bounce again to make
like,
you feel better.
Do they really want to make the playoffs?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
We're really acting like it.
This is very true. Alas. Okay, cool. Well, I think we gotta run here. This was a lot of fun. Mike, any closing? You can close it out, buddy.
No, I mean, this is great. The playoffs are coming. I think we're going to aim to do at least one more show before the playoffs begin, and then we're back to normal. Enjoy that. We have a lot of great stuff coming on SBNation.com this week, including Sierra on the Indiana Pacers, but also Tim on Q&A with Daryl Morey. We had a big story from Tyler Tynes just now about the Sacramento protests. He was there for a number of days, very thought-provoking. We've got stuff from Tom. We've got stuff from Paul. We got a drawing board coming later this week, video-wise, cool. Which is going to really help make people think. Not team specific.
Cool.
So we'll see how that goes. I mean, we have a lot of other stuff as well. There's going to be more James Harden things, so Rockets fans can get excited about that.
Nice.
And then the playoffs begin, and we'll obviously be on top of that.
Excellent. All righty. Well, until next time, everybody, this is the Limited Upside Podcast.